Mr. Jack Robinson, Rio One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Robinson?
Yes, I was born in Fulham, in London, on the 3rd of August 1925.
Could you tell us a bit about your family background, circumstances?
My father worked at J. Lyons as a baker, baking Swiss rolls, and many other things. And my mother, when she was younger, was a dressmaker, making dresses for the wealthy, should we say, the aristocracy type people. And they lived in, always have lived in London, mostly in the Battersea sort of area. And we went to Fulham a bit later on in their lives after they married. And I was born there. And then we moved to Heston in Middlesex in 1936, where an earphone in our back garden that we had there probably inspired me to join the IRA in the first place.
I'll come back to that. Was it a comfortable upbringing?
Very comfortable, yes, no problem at all. I can think of no problems at all. Both were dedicated to looking after me, shall we say.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
No brothers and sisters, no.
And what about your education? What was the first school you went to?
The very first school in Fulham was the junior school, it's called Lily Road Junior School. And then after that, I got a scholarship to go to the Central School, as it was called in those days, in Fulham. But in the meantime, we decided to move to Heston. And when we moved there, they decided you're out of the area, so therefore you have to have another examination. So I had to go to another junior school to wait until I was ready to take the next test. Again, I got this scholarship to go to Spring Grove, as it's called Spring Grove Selective Central School in Isleworth, which was something between a grammar school and a senior school that existed in those days. You could go there as a free-going person, but it's £5 a term or something like that. But I went there for 4 years until I was 16.
Now, how did you do at school? I mean, obviously you did fairly well, but was there any particular subjects or things that you excelled?
We had the Royal Society of Arts examination, because after 2 years at school, you were channeled into either a commercial form of study or a technical one. I went into the commercial study part and studied bookkeeping and shorthand and things like that. I took the RSA certificates in bookkeeping and arithmetic and got a credit in bookkeeping. That made me think, rather worrying me a bit, I didn't want to be a bookkeeper, but I was interested in the idea of it really at that time.
You enjoyed maths and bookkeeping,
right? Yes, all that sort of stuff, yeah.
Did you have much of an interest in sport?
I had an interest in it, but being of a diminutive size, relatively, it narrowed it down to the sort of sports I preferred. Football, or playing football, was one of the things I could do. When it came to the physical training part, we had our physical training instructor was an ex 1936 Olympic Games gymnast, and therefore we concentrated a lot on doing gymnastics, which I could do being smaller, that didn't worry me too much. But the other heavier types of rugby and all that sort of thing, that wasn't quite the right physique for that. So my interest mostly was in normal physical training type thing, gymnastics, and the football, really, that's what I concentrated on.
Did you have any particular interests outside of school, any hobbies, or were you a member of any of the boys?
I model aircraft, although I might
Was that because of this airfield near you?
That interested me. The planes flying over our house have got our house backed onto the airfield, so in those days they came right over the house. That interested me, started interesting. I wanted to find out more about them, so I started making models of them, flying models and static ones. And other hobbies, well, I did a lot of reading in those days, with quite a lot of fiction, mostly detective stories.
And were you a member of any of the boys' things? What sort of activities did you do with them?
We didn't go to camp. It was a very new group that was formed in the local church. We just been built and we moved to Heston. And I joined the Scouts there, and I wasn't a member of the church, but I became a member so I could join the Scouts, really. And we did normal scouting activities of playing the sort of games that scouts play in the hall and learning those knots and all that sort of stuff. So it helped me because you had to learn knots in the Air Force after when it came to it.
Was there much of a military tinge to it? I mean, they had there was a military origin to the scouts. How much was left by the...
I wouldn't describe it as that. But looking back, at the time, I didn't think it was too much. It was disciplining, but not military in that sense. Almost strict. But maybe that was the influence of our particular scoutmaster at that time. Maybe he didn't run it in that way, but it wasn't military. Yeah, I think it was that.
And any other boys' organisations or organisations in Lumbro?
Yes, we call it such the school Model Railway Society. It's a take when I built the train so long on Saturdays. I had joined them all together and we'll talk about the laboratory where they did this. But that was an incidental thing.
Now, you'd be at school. When the war broke out, as the war came nearer, did you have any interest in what was going on in Germany, in Europe, of the rise of fascism, things like that? Was that sort of a thing, an issue to you before the war started?
I wouldn't say so anyway. No, it seems as though it came upon us. The year before the war started, 1938. It was of interest because of change in the landing of Heston and all that on the tour came 38 and 39. And then when he came in 1939, with his famous document or whatever the rest of it, I ran out to where he rode nearby, where I knew his car might be going to go onto the Great West Road. And I saw him go past in the car, which was a very friendly thing, but the importance of it all didn't really mean too much, except the parents kept saying, we've got a war coming type thing. At school, nothing was said about this at all.
Did your parents have a personal view, though? I mean, had they been in the First World War? They'd been alive, but had they... Did he say anything about his experiences?
I did, many times. He was a guest in the First World War, and he tells it maybe sort of stories of being on a Lewis one crew where it was hit the trench he was in. A British shell fell short and went around the top of the trench and hit the chap at the end and killed him. We never forgot that. And later goes, when we went up to it, he was in the King's Own Scottish Borders. It was in the Surrey Regiments originally, and they got the King's Own Scottish Borders because they were. Shot up to pieces and the rest of it. And we went to go and find out some names and the Royal Honour and all that sort of stuff in Scotland and the regimental archives. So he did say a lot about it, but his war was probably a great deal different. He thought of the coming war being similar, probably without realising that.
Did that darken your picture of what the war might be like? You know, his bad experiences?
Yes, in a way it did. I didn't like the idea, of course. I wasn't very keen on the idea of a war, not knowing quite what form it was going to take anyway. And thinking of it going to take place in another country, it was not quite the same as realising that someone's going to drop bombs on the other. When the silence went on that 3rd of September in 1939.
Did you hear the radio broadcast?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What did you think as you heard it?
My stomach dropped to the head a lot, really. I suddenly felt, what's this going to mean to us all? You know, how is this going to be? How long have we got virtually? That sort of thing. It was maybe an overreaction because, nothing happened too much in the first few months anyway, except the siren sounding.
What did you think? What happened when the siren? Because they did sign, didn't the siren?
Without fail, I would say, right. Throughout the war, all the time I was living at Heston, when every time the sun, like everybody else, my stomach dropped to hell about, well, is it tonight? So we had a house going into another one, but there was a tracing link, whatever it was, a way in between us. That was perverted into what my father and my uncle next door thought was a safe place, but of course it probably wasn't, but we felt safe in this. But we didn't like the idea of the Anderson shelter in the garden because you know, underground a bit there, half underground, and we thought that didn't seem quite right. We put the stuff padded on. In this coziness, we got wooden bunks in there for about 10 people in this space. And the local neighbours who haven't lost anything were invited in. My grandmother came, and two grandmothers came and stayed at times. And we went into this journey where, foolishly at times, walked out to see what was going on with other cover over our heads, not yet. It was a bit naive in this sort of thing at first, and then the sun realised I don't think it wasn't a shrapnel we had to fall around the house on the shelf that's waiting for me as aircraft guns. So we were in the aircraft guns outside the house on the mobile ones, which were as our windows every now and again when they went off, but we cheered at the time because we thought that was doing something, raising our morale, if you like, really, if nothing else. And so, and when it Heston itself was attacked several times, obviously a deliberate attack, I don't know, never mind. And so it was a photo reconnaissance unit there, and Spitfires and planes and all sorts of aircraft there. And it was being attacked, and we searched by several places. We saw an aircraft hit them, all that sort of thing. But the big danger to me was the shadow falling around. It hit a pattern on the outside of the garden, on the roof. And, there's no windows smashed from bombs. The bombs dropped, I would say, about a quarter mile away at the... No, but near that front, it's 100 yards away in the cage, but it never broke our windows. There's always gun there that side, which annoyed us a bit, really, if only fire on that corner. And we're all terrified of us all the time. You've got a helpless, there's nothing you can do except... You know, wherever you were, to me, I thought, wherever we are, I can't believe it's going to be a direct hit, but it makes any difference where we are, even in a public shelter. You know, when at school, we had public shelters, get to those sports fields where the shelters were built, during lesson time. And I was saying, I have to think, well, how is this going to save us, really, except from shrapnel.
Was it underground at the school?
Partly, you had a bit sticking out of the ground. Most, where you were, was actually below ground level. It's like all these public shelters are direct hits. On anything, I learned later, so it wouldn't make any difference, really. It wouldn't save us. Yes, it was one of these freak type things, which did happen. Bombs dropped and the bowl of eggs stayed as they were, sort of stuff. And everybody else was killed. You know, this is sort of a silly situation that we saw so much in the press. But, I think my answer to me is that look, what I thought the bomb is an ultimate thing, and therefore it's the fact more from the bombs and also from the anti-aircraft guns, which we had just by the other side of Heston Airport, it was open field. And there they had a big gun batteries there. And so, although we didn't have as much actual damage done in the area as in the East End, for instance, it was still pretty lively at times, and very frightening.
What about things like the blackout? Was that rigorously enforced?
Rigorously, yes.
How did you do it? I mean, it seems... was it just curtains, or did you paint the windows?
Curtains, and there was a brown paper, interleaved brown paper with a sort of tile stuff in between, which we pinned up at the windows or made frames and put the windows with it. And we had curtains as well. We had to have the strips across the windows supposedly to help the glass flying away. Very ineffective. Okay, if it was some distance away, but a near bomb or shell or whatever. Most of it was morale boosting, thinking you're actually doing something. My parents got a Morrison shell from me, the indoor one, which was like a gigantic metal table, which weighed about 3 tons or something. And they went under that, and I went off to the Air Force. They dived under that during the race. And they felt safe under there. If the house collapsed, they wouldn't be buried. They'd be buried within this shelter. Someone could perhaps get them out at night, keep them away from risk for quite a while.
So they stopped using the alley between the two houses?
Right, yeah, that's right. Well, it was a bit cold out there in the winter. We put sandbags on the sandbags, inside, outside, and everywhere else. My father, the hand of the carpenter, made the bunks. And my grandmother from Fulham is with my parents. They're alive and time, which is full of jokes and all that sort of stuff. And she went to her own house in Fulham when once an incendiary fell in her garden. She was, you know, 78, 78 years then. She had a heavily built one. She went up for the same bed on it like everybody else was told to do, and everybody was running like my head, and she went and did this. It was all fussing with that, this sort of thing. Cheers up a little bit. It was the biggest factor, as you perhaps will know, was the morale, displaying that morale, really. And it's the unknown with the airways. I think, to me, it's not knowing when you hear a bomb fall, is it coming to you? And so we learned that if you could hear it, probably it's not. You know, if you can't hear it, then maybe that's it. We took that sort of philosophical view of it. It's pretty hair-raising. And then later on we got used to it, you know, at 6 o'clock in the evening the sirens would go, and 6 the next morning they go off again. Meanwhile my father was carrying on cycling to work from Heston to the county hall in Kensington on his bike down Great Road. Literally he'd run a march or something. Had to go with the show must go on sort of stuff. And crazy, really. And as soon as he got home tired out, the signs would go again. But mostly it was night time. It was pretty, most nights you missed the night sleep and night out and night, and sometimes all through the day as well. On certain days, but the daylight days, never got patches of flowers, but the signs went nevertheless, so we thought we'd come. And of course, those were only farm bombs.
I'll perhaps come on to that. How did in what other ways did the war affect you? I mean, one obvious one, I suppose, is rationing.
That's right. Yes. At first, nobody really felt. Nobody really felt us any much of a hardship. You know, people grumbled about not getting marmalade or sugar or this sort of stuff. But actually, you learned how to use it, and it was in. All the grocers told you that it was all, don't worry about it, it's all okay. All trying to get the extra bits that might exist. The wet market existed at no one. You were stopped at the tube station and said, you want some that, you want some food ration vouchers and the other sort of stuff.
Would you buy them?
No, I never did. And you could, of course, go into a restaurant and have a meal, really. A maximum price for them, I mean, it was 10 or 6 months or something, or shilling up for at one time, and you go and get a meal for shilling and a half, just in one course. And, you can go to the West End and have a meal in Ryan's Corner House for, I think, went up to 5 shillings eventually, the full course. And, of course, if you wanted more than that, they just put it down as 2 people bins. So all these sort of things made life a little bit easier. Certain things vanished. My latest brother had never seen a banana until the war finished. But it's things like this which are symbolic of the war, really. Sort of rationing it as such. We got a ration. When we went on leave in the office, we got a ration rations we took home and gave to her to add, so we didn't have to find food out of their own ration.
Was that clothing? That was rationed as well. Anything else?
Right, it was. Strange things, really, but because so many people were in uniform of some sort anyway, WVS or whatever they were, land army, all heading into the airport, people wore that most of the time. They're civilian clothing was in short supply, but no one really wants to wear it. They all want to be seen. To me, anyway, so it came over to me in those days, but they all wanted to be seen in something, doing something. We weren't allowed to wear in the force of civilian clothing on the Sunday. But if you did, then people are going to say, why aren't you in the force of young chap like you sort of stuff? So no one did it. And people at home with grey hair, they were going grey or whatever. They were considered to be too old for it anyway. And those who were in reserve occupations who were. Were held back by their company from being conscripted, so they in very secure jobs. And so they stayed in the factory doing the key, what was considered to be the key jobs, eventually they had to go. So there was this, as far as Kevin's, really, I don't think you're worried too much about it. It's just the incidents that occurred in the church and things that wore out since. I don't think people bothered to have gone by about not being able to get a suit. Those who could have plenty of money to go and get one done anyway, perhaps in other stuff.
What about gas masks? Because that was seen as a big threat at the start of all gas, wasn't it?
That to me was one of the very worrying things. The idea of a gas mask. And when I first put on a civilian, got a civilian gas mask, I thought, well, that is terrible. They're going to be going to die of suffocation inside this smelly, rubbery thing. But we never had to use it, of course. And we just didn't have to care about that long when we found out that nobody's going to bother to use gas. It's not good enough for a weapon of war. And so, the most of the disappeared into cupboards. People carried them, and eventually they were carrying empty boxes of their lunch, and that's not their gas mask. You have to be saying that you were stopped, and as a wine got your gas mask, the police stopped you and got someone and said, why don't you carry a gas mask? But when it came to wearing a gas mask, the forces gas mask, and they were going with the nozzle and all that stuff. That seems to me much different. Indeed, they had a gas test, a very, very nasty gas that had been tested with.
We'll come on to that. What about how did the war affect your school life?
It interrupted quite a bit really because we spent during the time of the raids, the earlier part, we spent quite a lot of time in the air raid shelter away from the school. We just took a really adverse work subject and tried to conduct a bit of a class in the but you can imagine with all the noise going on here, going on outside and that sort of stuff, and people rushing about and the anxiety of the whole thing, you couldn't really concentrate. So, any time a teacher not coming in one day because something had happened to them, maybe in this thing. So it was interrupted quite a bit. And it did affect, I think it did affect, I felt that. I was missing something somewhere, but what could I do about it? There's nothing I could do. We just have to take whatever was given as far as education is concerned and hope for their stuff.
Was there any form of like OTC or anything at the school that organised?
No, nothing like that. People joined the cadet forces on the outside, the units of cadet force OTC or the cadets or whatever, and if they wanted to.
Did you join at that stage while you were at school, or did you join there? Any other effects of the war before you left school that you put your finger on?
No, it was very much a routine type existence, really. A survival type existence. You had to get into a routine of doing things a certain way because of various factors like the blackout, like the rationing, like the raids that we met and the sort of thing. That was a predominant thing to me, that you need when you've got that from other sports, I was 4 or 7 or 6 o'clock in the sound, but it's been on for 18 months of continuously doing this. And after a while, it's all around. So I still affect the school in that respect. I'm home, but you couldn't concentrate really, but it's another thing that's taking place.
So fatigue would be a problem. I mean, just overall tiredness and.
That's right, you get school tired, you can wait half a night perhaps. And very few people would really settle down to sleep. I suppose they went down the London Tube, maybe. They went to these deep chances there at underground stations. They were probably quite safe, but except that they were some of those muscles and stuff, down shafts and whatnot. My uncle lived next door, he was a two-ton driver on the district on trains, and he was taken through the central, on the central line, not the southern line. And he was going through, the station, what was it, pretty deep. Well, there was a very deep shelter, very much underground there, and he went through about 5 minutes before one got down there and killed about 20 people down there. So, these sort of things affected us all when it happened. Just, very, very, very nasty.
Where did you get your news of what was going on in the war? Was it the radio, was it newspapers, or how?
Well, it was the radio, really, because we listened to that the whole town to see what the hell was going on. The newspapers were a little bit behind time also, not the way factual mode, but they were told what they wanted to hear. They said 25 aircraft were lost last night, we knew it might be 50 probably, but the authorities at 25, that was just, that sounded a bit wrong. And then eventually when some of the news, and you knew from other sources that this might be correct, it settled down a bit. At first I think they were just telling you, trying to cheer you up there, and later on there's a much higher temperature dramatically.
Was the radio very important to you then? I mean, now it's television, of course,
radio,
but what about...
Oh, yes, they carry on constantly, the whole time. Far more than we have television on now, but it's day and night. You know, during the night, you carry on, if there's anything on TV, there's always something somewhere you can find out somebody who's desperate for news the whole time. And another the other aspect of it was when I was 7 months in the south, and I was... one night and said, we're from the Ministry of Information, and there's a Ministry of Information Corps. And would you like to be interested in having a board for the outside? I said, we've got notices, we want to make sure we're doing intelligent. So I thought the same thing. And I thought something, oh, really? And that's been very, that's the first thing you could put off with. Anyway, they had the board for that outside, and there was some notices that were going to us the following day. I said, well, we're coming back various times for you to put things out there to tell you what's happening and all this sort of stuff. So I sent my father home to dig a hole in his front garden and put this post in there, like a for sale sign. And they came back actually, gave us these forms up there. But meanwhile, it generated a lot of active rethink in assessing the ways to handle the station fees. This is such a really sort of quiz coming because it's the wrong thing happened, really. But the idea was that, I suppose, was we're getting near to the idea that we might be invaded, so therefore, we've got to have some sort of information. This radio and all this stuff will be cut off, probably, because of the. Security reasons and whatnot, so I couldn't quite see what they were doing, but it was another idea to stimulate their interest.
Were there any particular favourite radio programmes at the time that you remember?
Yeah, I think like everybody else's, was the Tony Hanley Itmar programme was a favourite. Looking back on it, I can't see quite see why really. But I would say that. And they were the ones that cheered us up. On Jack Warner, his program, the comedy program. Those who cheered us up, we got 4-0 every week or whatever. But music, of course, was played quite a bit. But otherwise, there's nothing more than mostly the artists were somewhere else who performed for the troops.
Was the cinema a big thing then? I mean, would you go regularly?
Well, I think every week, if not twice a week, probably. I think certainly every week. We had a choice of three cinemas from the three different big groups that existed. But then we go to one of them once a week. But I was at school, we discussed what was the best one to go and see, set the stuff, and then that's where we go and discuss it afterwards. It was a topic that was far more discussed then than it is now, really.